Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. Money does strange things to people, as Anna Lake Ju notes in her latest book for Harvard University Press. In Madagascar, loggers flush with cash from the rosewood trade don't quite know how to react to their newfound largesse, sometimes demanding less money for their wares out of confusion. Rumors abound in Madagascar of how loggers make their money. There's no way that simple wood could garner so much profit, people say, so observers think they must be trading something else, like human bones. Rosewood, Endangered Species Conservation and the Rise of Global China by Anna Lake Ju studies globalization, the rise of China, and global environmental politics who trade in one commodity, Madagascar rosewood. She is the professor of environmental policy at Wageningen University in the Netherlands, a veteran of the United Nations Environment Program in Geneva, and a former Peace Corps volunteer in Madagascar. Her work has been published in Science, Geoform, and Political Geography. In this interview, Anna and I talk about rosewood, the commodity, the cultural product, and the conservation target in China and Madagascar. So, Anna, thank you so much for joining me on the Asian Review Books podcast. You know, I want to start with, you know, rosewood itself, you know, as a thing, as a commodity, as a natural product. You know, where does it come from? What kinds of climate does it grow in? And, you know, I guess what's the forest that it grows in?
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for having me. Yeah, so rosewood is a precious tropical hardwood. It grows throughout the tropics in Latin America, Africa, Southeast Asia, usually in more humid tropical forests, like you would think of a tropical rainforest, but also sometimes in drier climates, like in West Africa, in the savanna region as well.
So, I mean, what makes rosewood so, I guess, so precious, so prized? Like, what sorts of goods are used for in, I guess, how's it managed to gain so much cultural status?
Yeah. So rosewood in Madagascar has been logged for a while, since before the colonial period, actually, and sent to France primarily. But since 2000, it's been revived, the logging industry in Madagascar, due to demand from China. And the demand in China is much, much, much more high than in France, and the value of the wood has become much higher. And it's due to this unique cultural heritage that the wood has in China that it doesn't have anywhere else in the world. Essentially, this type of wood is deeply associated with the type of traditional Chinese furniture that dates back to the Ming Dynasty, so 1300s, 1400s in China. And at that time, the wood was used to make thrones for emperors, desks and wardrobes for the Chinese imperial literati. It was deeply associated with the elite classes in late imperial China. And really one of the foremost symbols of social status one could attain in dynastic China at the time. And I guess now, fast forwarding to 2000 and onwards, as Chinese consumers get more wealthy, it's not just Western style consumption that they're engaging in, but this desire to re-engage with Chinese traditional culture. And rosewood has become one of the foremost status symbols that's reemerged in this consumer culture that China is now experiencing.
So, I mean, let's talk about China today. I mean, you in the beginning of your book here, I talk about some of the stories that have come up about, you know, newly wealthy Chinese people trying to buy these cultural products, bring back these cultural products. You tell the anecdote of the businessman who bought historical bowls looted from the Summer Palace, then shocked onlookers by drinking from them. I wonder if you might kind of talk a bit about how a lot of this newfound wealth in China has been expressed through, I guess, people trying to buy these cultural products, kind of get this cultural status.
Yeah. I mean, I think to understand the current revival in this traditional icon, it's first important to realize that it's not just this continuous valuation of the wood. So from the late imperial China to now, that there was this drastic upheaval during the Cultural Revolution, So that would be 1966 to 76, like this drastic upheaval in the value of all traditional icons in China, but rosewood being one of them. And so I think that the people who experienced that, that upheaval of the Cultural Revolution, and sometimes had their rosewood furniture stolen from them or just confiscated by, the Red Guards, or stolen and burned in the streets, that type of thing. The people experiencing that, or who have experienced that, are now getting wealthier, getting older and wealthier, and buying back that kind of lost cultural heritage. So it's not just a seamless transition kind of from the dynastic period and then a revival in consumer spending now. But that being said, it is this kind of, now we're seeing this type of conspicuous consumption to a certain extent of elite Chinese cultural goods that are just very valuable, by people who endured the hardships of the Cultural Revolution and came out of the Cultural Revolution. For example, the person mentioned in the book, he was a taxi driver and had good investments and became a billionaire and bought this chicken cup, this porcelain cup looted from the Beijing Summer Palace long ago.
So I like to kind of shift now to Madagascar, which is the source of where all this rosewood is coming from. You're traveling there, I guess, as part of your research. What was that trip like, and what did you actually experience while you were there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I initially, before my research, I lived in Madagascar as a Peace Corps volunteer. So and in the part of the island, like this northeastern corner of the island, where the rosewood trade is kind of what they call the heart of the rosewood trade, because it's the region of Madagascar where rosewood still grows, where it hasn't been logged to extinction, basically. And so that was in 2010, beginning of 2011. And I lived there for about a year, and it was, I saw this was at kind of the peak rosewood boom time. In the town that I was living in, you could see new motorcycles. Anytime they had houses with big walls, people would say that it's rosewood behind those walls, or those walls, are built from rosewood, and in a sense that it's rosewood money that built the walls. Sometimes there'd be like parties on the side of the road, and they'd say, oh, that's a rosewood boss having that party. There were moments of kind of like, abundance that you wouldn't normally see otherwise in this kind of rural Malagasy town, basically. And I saw it, and so I, experienced the rosewood trade first by just those, like the economic fallout coming from the trade. But I also went into Maswal National Park during that time as well, and actually saw the logging as well happening. They're bringing rosewood logs, through the villages eventually to the coast for export as well. And that was, in the beginning of 2011. And then I returned in 2014 and 2015 to do field work, so as to do my PhD research, and returned to the same place. The rosewood boom was not quite as high. In fact, in 2014, people were just coming back from like this big pre-election boom, logging boom that happened for the 2013 elections, at the end of 2013. So I heard a bunch of stories about rosewood logging for the pre-election boom, where the government essentially allowed somewhat of a rosewood free-for-all.
So who actually could you describe some of the rosewood loggers that you're able to meet, if you were able to, what are their lives like? What are their backgrounds like?
Yeah, well, so I mean, it ranges. So there's many loggers that come from the villages, surrounding where rosewood grows, surrounding the national park. And these are typically very poor people, make less than a dollar a day. just live in, you know, like huts, Ravnala huts outside of the park, sleep on straw mattresses, don't have electricity, do some subsistence rice farming probably. And then it ranges from there to kind of the higher level traders or the youth that comes from the city to come to the countryside to log rosewood, and they're a little bit more well-to-do, but probably also definitely not rich, all the way up to kind of the highest level traders that they wouldn't be engaging in the logging themselves, but, you know, live in the cities and ultimately handle the export business, and they can, you know, can be billionaires.
You know, one thing that kind of struck me in kind of reading the stories you would tell about these rosewood loggers is that they seem to be surprised at how much money they actually could make from rosewood logging. And you tell stories about, you know, how there would be loggers who, when they were told how much money they would get from their wares, that they would turn around and say, "Oh no, that's too much money. You have to pay me less." Just out of confusion that they would actually be paid so much. Or, you know, loggers kind of flush with cash, just doing strange things with their money, throwing it at store people and not paying attention on how much money they were spending or throwing away. Just kind of how did these loggers kind of deal with their newfound largesse?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was very strange for someone who goes from sleeping on a straw bed, for example, each night to, you know, making up to $1,000 in a day. But the thing about the money, this kind of influx of money in Madagascar, in the region, is that it's this region is known for two things. It's known for rosewood and it's known for vanilla as well. And both have this boom bust dynamic where you get a lot of money coming in a short period of time. So vanilla is this other export commodity that really has extreme fluctuations in price. So together, rosewood and vanilla kind of create this culture of spending that they call, in Malagasy, you call hot money, right? It's vula mafana. It's hot money where you get money, and as soon as you get it, you want to spend it. You want to spend it, and sometimes in like very obvious ways, like mundane trips to the bar, where you just buy, you know, all the alcohol in the bar, or you go and say, "What's the finest liquor? I'll have that," and then take like, you know, I'll have the whole bottle and just take a shot and leave, or what have you. But sometimes more bizarre spending stories that I heard about, like, you know, pasting money to chameleons, or right, another story was about buying a box of mangoes and then just smashing it by the side of the road, smashing like ripe mangoes. And so all of these are hot money, the vula mafana stories. And with the logging, you get them, but with vanilla, you really get them as well, because the vanilla crop during boom times, vanilla can be more than the price of silver. And rural farmers that really don't make a lot of money get paid in one lump sum for their year's crop. So when the price is high, it's not frequently, but when the price is high, yeah, people do ridiculous things with the money. And these two export commodities are linked together in this way through this culture of hot money spending.
No, I'm going to sound like a development consultant when I ask this question, but I mean, it's the kind of thing people will like look at this and go like, "Ah, this is a problem with financial literacy. They don't know to save money, invest money." I guess kind of in this hot money thing, I mean, how like psychologically have they dealt with kind of this like boom and, as I said, this boom and bust cycle where, you know, you'll have really good times, but then of course you'll have really bad times too. How do they make it through this like very strong commodity boom and bust cycle?
Yeah. I mean, to look at it from a development lens, it is like highly problematic. And you can, to a certain extent, say, right, there's in this region, there isn't a culture of savings, because honestly, there hasn't been a need for it. The vanilla boom and bust, I mean, vanilla has always been boom and bust, but since 2000, the government, the Malagasy government, kind of liberated the price. So they stopped setting the price so much so that it really, so that farmers would experience the highs and the lows. And this was kind of at the behest of the IMF and the World Bank to kind of liberate prices and have free markets and whatnot. And so it was, and after they did this, so they did this in like the late 1990s, I suppose. And then in 2000, there was a cyclone that devastated the crop, and the price shot up into uncharted territory. And so since 2000, what's happened is this like boom and bust in vanilla, then rosewood, then vanilla, then rosewood. And it's really kind of, yes, been unproductive in terms of development because it's unreliable and people don't have a culture of saving money. And even more than that, it's money is a liability. To keep the money, to keep that amount of money, thousands of the equivalent of thousands of dollars in one's hut, Ravanella hut, right under your mattress or whatnot, is a huge liability. So getting rid of the money sometimes is better. And if you can get rid of it in durable goods and investments, like buying a tin roof or something, then that's good. But there's only so many circuits for this sudden influx of money to go to. So it's not always these long-term investments that would be better for development.
You know, so another thing that kind of struck me kind of reading your stories from the field, as it were, is the fact that like no one is too expensive, but the fact that people in Madagascar didn't believe that rosewood could make people so much money. And so there's like all these conspiracy theories as to kind of how loggers were actually making their money. I think human bones is one that kind of jumped out at me. But kind of how does the rest of Madagascar society kind of see the rosewood trade?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's the people I talk to in the region talking about rosewood. Yeah, for them, it does not make sense why this particular wood makes so much money, right? I mean, woods, they understand the value of wood, but like compare rosewood to palisander, for example, which is not demanded in China at the moment, and so not like much less the price. And they're not quite sure why this particular wood makes so much money. And the same with vanilla, actually. But people in Madagascar do not use vanilla to cook with at all. They don't use vanilla to really do anything with. It's only for export. And when you tell these people and talk to them about, well, vanilla is used kind of as a spice for cooking, for flavor and fragrance. I got the suspicion talking with some of my friends about it that they don't think it's just for that. Like there must be some other explanation. Like they've heard that explanation, but there must be some other explanation as well. And so then you get this bones, the bone, like the rosewood bosses that export the rosewood from Madagascar are actually dealing in bones, which to Malagasy people is a much more valuable, like it's a culturally speaking, bones are like probably one of the most culturally important material substances in Malagasy culture. So it's like it makes more sense that they would be worth so much more. With vanilla, some of the stories are about like it's used to make dynamite or tires is one of them, but something much more pivotal, like more pivotal products than simply like flavor and fragrance, for example. So that's people in the region having all sorts of conspiracies about the products. And I think larger, like looking at the country in general, I mean, most of my research was definitely in the region, so I'm not going to speak for the country as a whole, but just looking at reporting on the topic, these bosses that are in the Northeast that are, they export rosewood, but they also oftentimes export vanilla as well. They're known at the country level. They're in the national government. Many of them are members of parliament or play other pivotal roles within the government. So they're very much known. And they're just known that they've become rich from these two export commodities that they've kind of monopolized the trade over.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You know, we've gone this far in our conversation. I'll actually talk about the environmental impact of rosewood logging. I wonder if you might kind of talk about what the environmental damaged effects of the rosewood trade is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so rosewood is, there are many species of rosewood in Madagascar, but they're kind of linked together when dealt with environmentally, when dealt with in terms of trade restrictions. They're, the genus is Dalbergia, so there any species within that genus, it's not allowed to trade, to export, or to trade locally, although it happens quite a lot. But so environmentally speaking, like how this logging is done contributes to the environmental impacts. But it turns out that because there is such little mechanization of the logging, and because rosewood's relatively not densely populated within any given forest, it's not like you don't have a you wouldn't have a clear cut of rosewood because you wouldn't have that many rosewood trees in a given hectare. The environmental impacts are not so bad. I mean, they're to the overall ecosystem, but to the species itself, there it will be and probably is now close to commercially extinct past a certain age. So past, past a certain diameter, really, is past 25 centimeters at breast height, basically. You won't be able to find rosewood trees in the national parks, except maybe at the most remote, hardest places to get to at that size. But at less than that size, you can. They're not valuably, you can't export them, so they're around. So it's kind of an interesting environmental dilemma where I think locally, many Malagasy people don't see it as endangered at all. They say it grows everywhere. There's a lot of it. It's just younger trees growing. But then at the global level, if you think about it as an endangered species, there clearly is an environmental impact.
And so how does this all link back to China? I mean, in kind of the latter parts of your book, kind of bring it back to China's approach to conservation, to environmental policy. How does the rosewood kind of trade then link back to China's approach to global environmental governance?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think we can see China's approach kind of by first looking at the Western approach to environmental governance in Madagascar and to the rosewood trade. And Western, I mean like the World Bank, the UN, to a certain extent, USAID, big international donors and NGOs, Conservation International, for example, working on the island and trying to combat the rosewood trade. So the Western approach has been very much stop the logging. Stop the logging at all costs, stop the export. And it often involves like militarized intervention, right, where the government sends in military style intervention to basically shut down the trade that's happening among everyone who's probably not connected to the government. If you do have elite connections, you probably can keep exporting the rosewood. So it's a type of, what happens is a type of monopolization of the trade. because of this militarized style intervention to basically just stop the logging at all costs, but leave it going for only those in charge. That's kind of my experience in talking to the people in living in the region and dealing with these kind of military interventions that happen every so often. But I think a more productive approach, and I think something that local people living in the Northeast would be more receptive to, is kind of focusing more on reforestation or developing kind of a sustainable forestry industry, or just collectively deciding what do they want to do with the rosewood that's left, as opposed to just prohibiting the trade entirely, and how might they grow more rosewood. And this is where you can look to China, because China is growing rosewood, you know, by far more than any other country, and they have like a entire techno scientific commercial enterprise to how to grow rosewood at a large scale and make it profitable, but also use these rosewood forests to kind of replace eucalyptus forests and make the landscape more sustainable, less having clear cuts every 3 to 5 years, and keeping trees on the land for much longer. So I think China, in their rosewood growing, in their rosewood plantations, provide this kind of alternative that many people in Madagascar would benefit from and would prefer over Western style interventions that are highly militarized and I would say do more harm than good.
So, I mean, there's obviously like this big debate about China's environmental policy. You know, there's the side that kind of sees this all as, I'm trying to think of the right word to describe this. They kind of see China's efforts towards conservation as kind of paper thin. You know, they talk up climate change, they say they're investing in green stuff, yet they're still buying up all these commodities overseas. Inversely, you have the argument says like China is quote unquote doing better than the West in terms of climate change, because they actually make it a core matter of policy, et cetera, you know, unlike the West, where it's a lot of talk and not a lot of action. I guess, how do you kind of see China's approach to conservation, to environmental protection, to environmental governance? I guess, how do you see, like, where do you think the line actually falls in terms of what China is trying to do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I definitely understand the arguments that Chinese environmental efforts are paper thin, or a lot of times the arguments are it's really the deeper motivation is more political control rather than actually environmental improvement, but really a means to control people by controlling the environment, controlling pollution and whatnot. And I totally understand that argument, and it makes sense. I agree with it. But I do think on some level there is something very fundamental in happening with Chinese people right now about being fed up with pollution, being fed up with environmental issues and injustices, and demanding from leadership environmental improvement. And in that sense, you can see the delivery of environmental improvement as kind of, you know, an attempt to meet the demands of the people and have social stability and whatnot. So I think there is some sincerity to it, to China's environmental efforts in that vein. But I also think that when we talk about environmentalism in China, it's kind of, we're talking about something a little bit different. It doesn't have the same history of environmentalism in the West. And like, we really can see that when you look at a place like Madagascar, for example, where all Western influence in the country is very much around, right, protecting wilderness and keeping these national parks, keeping these spaces, protected, largely free from people, biodiverse, pristine, right? Basically to keep them pristine. This is why we don't want people in there logging rosewood, because we want them to be pristine and biodiverse and whatnot. And I think Chinese environmentalism is, you could say, a little bit more utilitarian. It has a different history that's not concerned with keeping wilderness pristine, but meeting needs of people, having a harmonious environmental system where, you know, it's people can be more or less in harmony with their wider surroundings, but not in a nature wilderness state, right? And the China's rosewood forests demonstrate this very well, this kind of ecological, like very heavy-handed for the part of humans, tampering with ecologies, but to make them better, to make them more ecological or whatnot. It's not an attempt to recreate a natural state. So I think when it comes to these ideas of nature and how to approach them at the global level, we see a big disconnect between approaches in China versus approaches in the West. And again, seeing how they resonate in a place like Madagascar, I think many people living there might be a little more sympathetic to a more utilitarian, more human-centered approach that you do see a little bit more in China in terms of using resources to develop sustainably, as opposed to kind of a pristine protectionist approach that comes largely from Western conservation groups.
So I have, I think, one last question for you, and kind of like, what's happened? Do you know what's happened with the rosewood market, the rosewood loggers in Madagascar, kind of since you did the lion's share of the research for your book? How has the market changed in Madagascar or in China?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Madagascar rosewood, the market really peaked in 2013, 2014. It was a big boom. And in China since then, and especially now with COVID, I've talked to dealers and what they say is that there's still a high price, but little turnover. So people are still holding on to their rosewood and not wanting to sell it for cheap. But not a lot of market turnover, not a lot of additional buying. But we have to remember that rosewood from Madagascar is, of all African rosewood varieties, it's the most expensive. It's very a very expensive rosewood, and that other rosewoods from different countries in Africa are a lot cheaper. And with them, we do see more recently a lot of turnover, a lot more cutting, especially in West Africa. And a lot more exports to China. So I think overall the market maybe has shifted a little bit from Madagascar to West African countries, where the wood's a bit cheaper, and the politics of the situation are a little bit different at this point in time.
So I think with that, that's a good place to interview with Anna Lake Ju, author of Rosewood, Endangered Species Conservation and the Rise of China. Anna, I actually have two final questions for you, which are, where can people find your work, and what's next for you?
Yeah, I'm happy for people to buy the book at Harvard University Press. Now I think what I'm moving on to look at is... So in the book, I talk about reforestation efforts, rosewood reforestation efforts, and now I'm looking at kind of tree planting in China more broadly, not just in terms of rosewood, but in terms of large-scale tree planting to combat climate change. So kind of using land use and carbon sequestration via tree planting, via increasing grasslands as a climate change reduction strategy. And looking at efforts where China does that within Chinese borders, but also in other countries outside of China as well. So kind of these environmental efforts to combat climate change via large-scale tree planting drives.
So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at @NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Twitter at @BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find countless other author interviews at the New Books Network at NewBooksNetwork.com. The ARB podcast is on all your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends if you want to continue to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with Lan Samantha Chang, author of The Family Chow. But before then, thank you so much, Anna, for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.